You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot runner.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor of 538. This week, I'm without Neil Payne and Kate Fagan, who are on vacation or flying to LA. So it's a special episode. That is the scoff, the gentle laugh.
It's not a scoff. I feel bad for the people who downloaded this podcast expecting Kate and Neil.
It's Nate Silver, everybody. Hi, Nate. Hey, Chad. Nate is editor-in-chief of 538, of course. We're going to talk about NFL ELO. We're going to do Sig Dig at the end of the show. We're going to talk about concussions and what secret formulas you have cooking up.
They're not secret. It's relatively transparent.
They're secret until this podcast, Nate. Okay. It's a big reveal. Okay. But first, one bit of housekeeping on our Madden challenge. For the last couple of weeks, we've been talking to listeners about playing as Walt Hickey, one of our writers in Madden. Walt went down to EA Sports and became a character in Madden. They measured his throwing accuracy, his power rating, his speed, all of their things. Some listeners have been trying to win the Super Bowl with Walt, and some listeners have won the Super Bowl with Walt, two of them. We're going to talk about that more when Neil and Kate are back. Nate, have you played with Walt in Madden?
I've not. When I play sports video games, I kind of do the opposite, which is that, you know, the guy who traded a paperclip and eventually got like a house. I take advantage of bad trade AI until I like wind up with like the American League All-Star team basically or something. So, and the team's very good. So yeah, I want the ostensible challenge of winning the championship, but I use my ingenuity to make it.
And you
want
to start with the Patriots. You want to work your way towards having Tom Brady somehow.
Yeah, being a Detroit sports fan, you start out with a fairly low baseline usually in most sports, but you know, with clever trading you can improve.
Okay. And so yeah, stay tuned, listeners, to hear about all the details about how people somehow won Super Bowl with Walt Hickey's, you can't even call it a sidearm throw. It was more sort of a side noodle throw in action. Okay, let's transition to Concussion Watch, where we check in on the people behind the concussion stats that we always hear about. This is a season-long effort of Hot Takedown, where we'll tell you how many people were concussed in that week of NFL play. And two people, by my count, using ESPN's Injury Watch, suffered confirmed concussions this week. And one extra player was added to our week one tally. So the extra player that was added was Eugene Monroe, an offensive tackle for the Ravens, and the two who were concussed this week as well were Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie for the Giants and Vontae Davis on a Monday night game for the Colts. That's two concussions in week two, seven in week one, nine total. Nate, I want to talk to you a bit about concussions because there was a new study that came out from Boston University and the Department of Veterans Affairs, and it looked at the brains of deceased football players. And it found that 96% of the NFL players that they did autopsies of had CTE, which is what we think develops when people suffer repeated hits to the head. That's a big number, but it's a self-selected sample.
Yeah.
These are people who volunteered to have their brains looked at after they died.
Who volunteered and I think suspected that they might have some type of chronic brain injury. I don't know. So to me, this study wouldn't alter your priors that much. On the other hand, my prior is not the NFL's prior, where they're like, oh, just ring his bell a few times. I mean, you know, it seems clear that the weight of medical evidence points toward this being a serious problem. I think the jury is somewhat out on, is this a catastrophic problem that affects half the people who play in the NFL? Does it affect 15%? I don't think we know. I don't think the NFL has been very helpful or will be helpful in trying to set up good protocols for scientific studies. So you rely on self-selected samples as a result. But, you know, I'm not sure this study tells us all that much.
So this is a question I had then. Is it only it's a big number. And at what point is a big number in a skewed sample? Maybe skewed isn't the right word, but a sample that is somehow not, you know, statistically ideal. Does it tell us anything? You're saying it would tell you something if you didn't think the NFL had a concussion problem.
So, yeah, if you said, oh, there's no – I mean, clearly if you have – 85 out of 88 or something, or 88 out of
87 90? Out of 91, yeah.
Okay. You know, if it were some very rare form of cancer, well, actually, I'm kind of making the wrong point. Yeah, I mean, you would assume it's higher than the incidence in the general population, that even if it were somehow only those 87, and how many ex-NFL players are there? Probably 10,000 or 20,000. I would assume that rate's a lot higher than in the general population. I don't know, right? So that kind of sets a floor, but without knowing, without having some type of random sample, it's hard to make too many generalizations.
And the trick is that they can't screen as of now with people who are still living for CTE, reliably at least. And so we're stuck in this place where the NFL will be able, or where some other side of the argument will always be able to say, well, it's a self-selected sample, we're not sure. But there's mounting evidence that there's probably something going on. But really, this is about scale. And it's hard, as you said, to get a sense for whether it's catastrophic or not.
One thing you can look at is you can look at when NFL players die. You know, there have been some studies around that. I think the answer is that they don't have particularly short lifespans relative to the male population average. But they do relative to people who make as much money as football players can make early in their careers, who are obviously, by definition, at least in their 20s and 30s, very athletic and healthy. So that's one kind of brute force approach, is look at death records and come to inferences from those potentially.
And as you look at this issue, which has been boiling now for years, it seems, do you think that we've passed the point where statistics are going to do something to change it, that now it's about for those who want to change the NFL, let's say, that statistics have done what they can do, and now it's about, you know, some major event that would have to happen on the field, some anecdote almost that supersedes the larger statistics?
No, I tend to think this is going to take a long time to burn and to really affect things all that profoundly. I don't think we've seen the definitive study. If you do get a study somehow that says, boy, this is top doctors in the world, and we took 500 randomly selected NFL players and 220 of them had CTE, right, then that would be a huge event, sort of like the smoking and tobacco.
The thing that was on The Insider, that movie.
Yeah. At the same time, you have to look at the history of how there was lots of smaller studies that suggested a strong link between lung cancer and tobacco, and big tobacco denied them, and it kind of wound up being the worst case scenario. So I'm not denying any of this. I mean, I think to me the weight of the evidence seems to point toward this being at least a very serious problem. Mm-hmm. I don't think though we've seen the one study that's a knockout blow.
Right. I guess my question is, are studies the thing that's going to change this? Or instead, is it going to be some type of event that happens on the field? Let's say, you know, Tom Brady is concussed and never comes back to play again, or something like that.
I'm struck by how big an industry the NFL is. And I'm a football fan. I'm not somebody who comes at this from, you know, some wacky perspective. I like watching the NFL on Sunday. But it is kind of amazing how some guy gets carted off on the field and has an injury which is often more severe than a concussion, and everyone forms a prayer circle, but then 10 or 15 minutes later, the game resumes, and it's as though nothing really had changed. The NFL is a very powerful institution, and people are really invested in the league. Lots and lots of people make their income directly or indirectly from the football industry, and so, you know, I don't tend to think that any one incident would change it all that much, but I think there could be gradual pressure. I mean, what if the player pool dries up a little bit because certain types of parents say, my kid's not going to play football? That could have an effect, potentially. It could have an effect on the younger audience for the league. There, you know, people will sometimes say, well, baseball's doing okay for now, but its median viewer is 55 years old or something. Could that happen for for football too? Could soccer eventually be a substitute? So I could be bearish about the state of the NFL 20 or 25 years from now, but I think that's the type of time scale that we're talking about. I don't think it's like, oh, Tom Brady gets concussed and all of a sudden we're playing flag football instead. I also tend to think that it's a little bit more hard to prove that the brutality of football is part of what attracts people to it too, and that you could have a phase 10 or 15 years from now where, you know, it's not a cool thing to do if you're like a liberal urbanite to watch football because you think it's too brutal. But red state America still does. There's a little bit of that now. You see a little bit of that with college football, for example, but I could see that accentuated, accelerated.
Splintering the fan base demographically, yeah. So let's move on to lighter topics. Let's talk about ELO ratings.
ELO.
Your favorite pet model. I don't even know what to call it.
So millions of people love ELO ratings, Chad. Okay. They write me. When the ELO ratings haven't gone up, they're like, why aren't we getting the ELO ratings?
So let's pause for a moment. Explain ELO ratings, as we talked about in this podcast before. Power rankings that have to do with who beats who historically. Yeah. You move up if you beat especially a really good team. You move higher up, down if you lose. Nate, who is ELO? Where does ELO come from?
So ELO was a mathematician and chess player. I should know more about his background, I suppose, but devised this very simple and elegant way to rate competitions. So chess players, people use them to rate colleges against one another, not in football, but in terms of academics and stuff like that. But it works really well for sports where you have head-to-head competition, which is to say most sports.
Right. And so, Nate, you have brought a tyranny of ELO onto 538. We have ELO for basketball. We have ELO for football. We have ELO for tennis players. What am I forgetting? ELO for hockey? You've done at some point, I believe.
We haven't done. Hockey would say all the teams are average and it's pure randomness. So I would want to do a hockey ELO at some point.
And baseball ELO, of course, is somewhere out in the distance for us.
Yeah.
Why ELO as this beautiful system to rank power ratings? What is so special about it as opposed to something like ESPN's Football Power Index, for example?
So for one thing, it's pretty transparent. So we can go and it takes a couple of minutes on our computer, on my computer, or now on our server, to run ELO for the entire history of the NBA or the NFL. Secondly, because the assumptions of it are really clear, so it forms a good baseline. There are some ratings, and I like FPI a lot, but there's kind of an uncanny valley, if you've heard that term, between ratings or models, so to speak, that are very simple. Say, here are my assumptions. We know it's not perfect, but this is an efficient way to take account of the information that we have, versus kind of kitchen sink models saying, hey, here is something that you would bet on in Las Vegas, and it's a little bit dirty maybe, but we know this works and hopefully has a good track record too. And there's kind of an in-between where it's no longer simple enough to be explainable in a sentence or two. At the same time, it's leaving important things out. And I think avoiding that area is important, right? So we tend to have models that are either really simple kind of toys like ELO or things where we say, you know, we really do want to design a model that's good enough to bet on. That's more like our election models, at least for the general election, I think. Where it's very carefully done. There are a lot of layers, though. The complexity increases. So, yeah, I have kind of philosophies about model building, I guess.
So the simplicity is an asset here. And so, but the simplicity also means that for someone like the Eagles, for example. So the Eagles had a lot of turnover in the offseason. But ELO doesn't care about players, right? It just cares about record and who you beat and who you lost to. And so how... It means that we have to wait a long time to know whether the Eagles' new personnel is as good is better or worse than last year's personnel, right?
It takes some time, but the funny thing is, if you look at ELO's preseason rankings, which all it does is it takes last season's year-end ELO and regresses to the mean by about a third, those are like 95% correlated with the Vegas standings. Anytime you can do 95% as well by using much, much, much simpler and more transparent assumptions, then that's an interesting device, I think, potentially. And it does catch up. I mean, especially in the NBA version where you do have 82 games instead of 16, when Michael Jordan leaves the Bulls, it doesn't know that. But after 10 or 15 games, it figures out the Bulls have to be really, really bad.
Right. And so it encourages patients almost that will wait for the model or whatever we want to call it to catch up with.
And in the NFL, you could probably do something with quarterbacks. I mean, I'm working on a piece that'll file to you later today, Chad, about the Saints. And when you see a big drop-off in a team's ELO rating, it often has to do with an aging quarterback or a quarterback controversy or something like that. So QBs play an especially important role. But there's value in simplicity, in part because you can say, here's a baseline against which we can evaluate the importance of Peyton Manning coming to your team or whatnot, or Tom Brady or anything else.
So ELO has also spit out some interesting results. Namely, it named a team that never won the Super Bowl as the best team of all time.
We're fighting against narratives, Chad, and not...
Listen, so this is what I want to talk to you about, Nate. The 2007 Patriots, 18-1, they lose to the Giants, the helmet catch, Tyree, all that.
Yeah.
They are the best team of all time, according to ELO.
Yeah.
But if I'm thinking of the best teams of all time, I'd probably think of someone who won a Super Bowl at some point. Now, what the point about ELO, though, is it's taking this team, that 2007 team, within the context of the larger Patriots dynasty, right?
Right. So it says it's more credible if you go 16-0 and then win your first two playoff games. So go 18-0 after you've had a number of good years. So it has 2004 Patriots as, I think, the second best team of all time.
Who did win a Super Bowl.
And they did win a Super Bowl. You know, the Patriots also won 16 regular season games, 16-0. No team has ever done that. They won by a very large margin of victory. Their one defeat came by 3 points. In general, as you have more teams in the league, it becomes more competitive. It's been a while since we had a major expansion in the NFL. ELO considers this a pretty good era for the NFL.
High-quality era. Lots of
So when we had a couple weeks, I don't know if you talked to Carl and Ben about this, right? But, for example, Pete Sampras doesn't fare all that well in men's tennis ELO because ELO says, you know what, there was not really a clear hierarchy of players. It was maybe a mediocre era for the league, right? That might be true a little bit for like the 72 Dolphins, for example, as you were in the midst of the post-AFL merger and you didn't have that many dominant teams really.
You're the undefeated Dolphins you're talking about.
Yeah. It was kind of much easier to go undefeated when you're not facing a Patriots type or 49ers type or Steelers or Packers type dynasty. It was a lull in between those. And it is kind of a chicken and egg kind of thing. It's like, well, maybe there wasn't a dynasty because the Dolphins and so forth beat them, but still ELO has mathy ways, despite its simplicity, to kind of make inferences about that.
And so working at 538 and doing Hot Takedown has really challenged like the way that I approach greatness, because that's what a lot of staff...
See, greatness and best aren't the same thing.
Okay.
Right? You know, which team should be most celebrated? I don't know. Probably the team that wins the Super Bowl, right? That's what every NFL player strapped to someone on him wants to accomplish. What this is saying, though, is that if you played any NFL team in history, getting weird Ben Morrissey hypotheticals here, that would be the team you'd be least likely to beat, is the 2007 Patriots.
And so that's, to me, what the tension is. The way I approach sports is probably thinking, I mean, I think the way a lot of people are taught to approach sports, and that's partly because of our parent company and the way that, you know, SportsCenter and everyone else exalts the great teams that win the championships, is not about best. It's about who wins. But what the statistical community within sports is really consumed with is bestness, if that's a word that we can create, is who is the highest quality, which team has the most value. And that's a pretty radical difference.
ELO, though, is actually more friendly to conventional wisdom than a lot of systems, where, first of all, it explicitly accounts for postseason play. If you look at the year-end ELO ratings and not the peak one, which is different, then like 13 out of the top 14 teams did win the Super Bowl. The Patriots are the exception.
The two of the top three didn't.
In the name of transparency, you have different versions.
Right.
So if you look at peak ELO, this is interesting. There are five teams in history that achieved a peak ELO of 1,800 or higher.
And 1,500 is the average. So that's well above average.
Yeah, only one of them won the Super Bowl. So you have some famous upsets, the 42 Bears. By the way, one thing I learned doing this is that people always say, well, the kind of Super Bowl era, there's a lot of fascinating NFL history pre-Super Bowl era. So our interactive can go back to the Canton Bulldogs and Frankfurt Yellow Jackets and Providence Steamroller and stuff like that and see how the franchises evolve. But yeah, the 68 Colts were one of the first teams ever to have an ELO rating above 1800. They lost to Joe Namath, of course. But, you know, it's a one-and-done series in the NFL. It's a little bit better than baseball and hockey because those sports are so random. But one reason why I find the NBA satisfying is that when you're playing seven-game series, it's very rare that you could point to an NBA team and say, you know what, I'm pretty sure they weren't the best team in the league. As much as, so ELO had the Warriors, I guess correctly in hindsight, favored over the Cavs this year. But if you won a seven-game series, then ELO would have said, that's so much information, these teams playing head-to-head, that it would probably have had the Cavs ahead by the end.
Right.
The NBA NFL, where you're one and done, it's a little bit different. I mean, clearly I don't think you can say the best team always wins the Super Bowl.
And what you're saying is what's attractive in the NBA is that the incentives are aligned. The best almost always equals great, and great almost always equals
best. Yeah, and I like that about the NBA, where there's so much randomness in other sports. You know, sports like the NBA and tennis, where you have very little randomness, are interesting in that you kind of are able to test hypotheses a little bit better about what affects teams. There's much, much less noise in those sports than almost any other.
Okay, let's leave the ELO conversation there, but I want to ask, Nate, every time I see your office door close, I think of this Tom Waits song called What's He Building in There? In which Tom Waits says, what's he building in there? And I wonder, what model is Nate building in there? What are you working on right now that you're really excited about?
So we have something called Carmelo, like Pagoda back in the day. It has some tortured algorithm. It's like career arc. We're trying to actually gain listeners. Maybe I shouldn't spell out the entire
acronym, yeah.
But basically, it's, if you know Pagoda for baseball, this is a kind of Pagoda-like thing for basketball, where it takes a player, you know, maybe it looks at Steph Curry and says, you know what, through this point in his career, Steph Curry looks similar to Michael Jordan, but also to Terrell Brandon and stuff like that. And so it builds probabilistic forecasts based on NBA history.
Okay, and so you'd be able to say then that Carmelo Anthony himself is most likely to be... Who?
It's really down on the Knicks, ironically, despite being named Carmelo. It's like, yeah, these guys drew all the short straws this year. So, yeah, so you can turn it into team projections, but also you can look 7 years into the future. So Andrew Wiggins, a guy that was much debated here, I think, at Hot Takedown or at 538 in general, you see, hey, you look 7 years out and just – playing in the NBA at 19 and being competent is a pretty good sign. So he actually gets down the road a pretty good projection. In fact, Andrew Wiggins, I think number one comparable is Carmelo Anthony. So, yeah.
So this is going to be called Wiggins in a decade.
Wiggins in a decade.
Yeah. Okay, Nate, let's leave it there. Carmelo will be coming soon to 538.com. All, you know, chart gods willing.
And Allison willing.
Allison willing, yeah. She'll be
credit where it's due.
We'll ask her that for the sig dig. All right, Nate, thanks for coming on to Half Takedown.
Thanks, Chad.
All right, with Nate out of the way, let's bring in Allison McCann, who brings us her significant digit every week. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
All right, Allison, it's just the two of us, Neil and Kate, off on vacation or in L.A. So what do you have for me for the significant digit?
This week, I'm calling it the 5x5. The digit is just five.
Okay. But, five twice over.
Five twice over. On Sunday, the U.S. Women's National Team played Haiti in their victory tour, and Carly Lloyd became the fifth American to score five international hat tricks. She had two consecutive ones against Haiti in their past two games. And another hat trick you might remember was in a World Cup final.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah. So she's just on fire and insane. And granted, these have not been very challenging games, but it's pretty remarkable to...
Has that continued into her club play as well?
Yeah, so her club team unfortunately didn't make the playoffs, probably because she missed the majority of it. But yeah, she was scoring a ton of goals when she returned and just seems to have not stopped since the World Cup.
So Carly Lloyd is one of five Americans who scored five hat tricks. Who are the other four?
They're all women.
Oh, okay.
I believe it's Cindy Parlow and Mia Hamm, and I forget the other two. But yes, all American women. So the men need to pick up on the hat trick game, that's for sure.
Right. It speaks to the dearth of strikers on the men's side and the greatness of strikers on the women's side.
Absolutely.
All right, Allison, thanks for coming in with that significant digit.
Thanks for having me.
That'll do it for this week's show. thanks to Nate Silver for guest paneling. Our video producer is Ryan Antel. We get production assistance from Jordan Shulkin. Our intern is Sarah Patterson. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others find the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.